On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A century ago, on the south side of Chicago, there was a bordello like none the country had ever quite seen. It was called the Everly Club, and it was more grand, more gilded, and more palatial than many a palace. Inside, the rich and powerful and well-placed men of Chicago society consorted with beauties paid a jaw-dropping wage for the time. Outside, angry preachers and political progressives railed against white slavery and moral turpitude. In that clash played out a great chapter in America's unfinished debate over vice and virtue. Up next on Point, Sex and the City of Chicago a Century Ago. We'll hear in just a moment from Karen Abbott. She's author of a new book called Sin in the Second City, the big story of the Everly Club and the enormous controversy over that in Chicago in those boom days. I'm joined right now first by from Berkeley, California, by Linda Gordon, one of the country's leading authorities on the progressive era, professor of history at New York University, author of The Moral Property of Women. Linda Gordon, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
We're going to hear in just a moment about an incredibly ornate, lush, posh, lavish bordello in Chicago, frequented by most of the great powers of that city for nearly a decade, about a century ago. But I wish you'd kind of set the political stage and the cultural stage for us. Look back a century. What was the place of sex and sexual commerce in this country?
Well, you know, they like to say that prostitution is the oldest profession, and it's pretty hard to find any society that didn't have some prostitution. But really, the heyday of prostitution, when it was in this country the largest per capita, you might say, was probably actually at the very end of the 19th century, that is, of the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Because I think that the size of the prostitution industry has a relationship to the degree of sexual repressiveness of the society.
So at the apogee of the Victorian era, we had the most prostitution.
Exactly. And that is one of the many reasons why Victorian morality was really very hypocritical in a lot of ways. This is a time in which a very, very high proportion of young men had their first sexual experience with a prostitute.
And if you look across the country then at the turn of that century, the end of that century, just how common? Just in the big cities or beyond?
No, you would find prostitution everywhere, though obviously nothing on the scale of the Everly Sisters establishment in Chicago would you find outside of a big city. But you also had a stratification of prostitution. In other words, there were prostitutes for poor guys, prostitutes for middle-class guys, and prostitutes for big spenders, which is the group that the Everly Sisters wanted to exploit.
Linda Gordon, stand by for a moment. We're going to look at the high end of that range in this hour, but it sat right at the margins of the part of town where it was the bucket of blood and why not names of much less glamorous establishments. Joining us right now from Chicago is Karen Abbott. She's author of the new book, Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. Karen Abbott, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we've begun to introduce the Everly Club, but I've seen the photographs, and it's not easy to convey just what a lavish establishment this was. Who were these sisters? And paint a picture of the establishment they built in Chicago for us.
Well, the sisters were these two mysterious, very cunning businesswomen who arrived in Chicago in the winter of 1899 from Omaha, where they had a sort of less opulent brothel, and they decided that Chicago was the ideal place for them to build the grandest bordello in the world. And they went about doing exactly that in the Levee District. They found a double mansion on the near south side on South Dearborn, and proceeded to just refurbish the entire place. As soon as you walked in the door, you had perfume shooting into the air. You had rich, lush Oriental rugs. They designed a dining room that was to look like a Pullman Palace car. They employed some of the finest chefs in the country. To give you an idea of the grandeur of the establishment, you know, their entrance fee just to walk into the door was $50.
And this is in 1900.
Yeah, when you know, a three-course meal was 50 cents. So they were not, and as Minnie said to everybody, you know, we do not entertain men without a checkbook. So,
and pretty fat checkbooks, or at least a lot of power. So here's Minna and Ada Everly. There's a little bit in your book where, that kind of sets the picture. I mean, they were right up against a much more down and dirty sexual trade, rough sex trade part of town. We should read a little bit for us about the Levee District of Chicago and how they might have seen it and understood it, Karen.
Okay, sure. It's this is a passage where Minna is looking out the window to survey the Levee District. Minna didn't have to see the Levee District to know what it was up to. Panders, an underworld term that served as both verb and noun, were outfitted in dandy ties and jaunty hats, lurking in corners and alleys. Eugene Houston and his wife, Lottie, the king and queen of the Cokies, weighed 30 pounds of cocaine and half as much morphine. Soon their salesmen would make the rounds. Funny thing was, Minna knew, Lottie was a college graduate who spoke five languages and in her spare time composed music and painted portraits. Down the street at the House of All Nations, Johns lined up at the $2 and $5 entrances. Too bad the suckers didn't know that the same girls worked both sides. Blind men cranked hurdy-gurdies, spinning tangled reams of melody. They reeked of sweat and blood and swine entrails, drifting up from the Union stockyards just a few blocks southwest. Mickey Finn hawked his eponymous special at his Dearborn Street bar. Merry Widow Kiddo, the famous peep show girl, warmed up her booth, breast twirling like pinwheels behind the glass. Levee piano players, professors they were called, cracked their knuckles before plucking out the hiccup notes of ragtime.
So there we are in the ragtime years with a palatial brothel right there on the edge of all that. Who frequented the Everly Club for the decade that it pretty well thrived in Chicago?
Well, anyone who was anyone in Chicago and from out of town that, you know, happened to pass through came to the Everly Club. Theodore Dreiser was a frequent client. Edgar Lee Masters, the poet. Jack Johnson, the famous heavyweight boxer. Marshall Field Jr., who was reported to have been shot there, was a frequent client. And one of the most famous incidents, of course, has to do with Prince Henry of Prussia, who came to Chicago and didn't care much about seeing any of the usual tourist attractions, but made sure the Everly Club was a primary stop on his tour here.
Did everybody know exactly what was going on inside those 30 rooms upstairs at the Everly Club, Karen?
Well, Minna and Ada were very discreet. They prided themselves on not naming names and on, you know, a sense of decorum. And a gentleman would feel free to sort of indulge himself without worrying that his name was going to appear in the newspaper the next day.
But was it a secret that this was essentially a high-class whorehouse?
Oh, no, not at all. They were quite open about that. But, you know, they also made a point that sex was almost beside the point there. It was a gentleman's club. A lot of men came just for the gourmet meals. A lot of men came just to socialize and to hear the three-stringed orchestras and to, you know, talk to these stunning creatures who were tutored in the literature of Balzac and who recited poetry. It was sort of a very high-class spa experience, if you will.
I can imagine a lot of people raising their eyebrows when you describe these as sort of pampered courtesans. So they were paid a lot for that time. But was it really such a great place to work? I mean, at the end of the day, they were still prostitutes.
Well, if just to put it in context, if a girl, you know, many women at the time were leaving their rural homes and trying to find work and excitement in the big city. If they were lucky, they could get a job as a clerk or, you know, in a department store, as a typesetter, as a domestic worker, and maybe make $6 a week. At the lesser whorehouses, they might make $15 a week. And at a place like the Everly Club, they made $100 a week. And also, you know, were outfitted in these beautiful gowns, ate gourmet meals, slept in silk sheets, and were very well taken care of. Minna and Ada did not treat their girls as disposable commodities, as many other madams in the district did. And I think that's, you know, they really wanted to elevate the business.
But outside the doors of that, I don't know, big brownstone, you might call it, the Everly Club, as you say, people knew what was going on, and there was a really roiling controversy about it. Great allegations of white slavery, preachers railing against what was going on inside. You know, what was the debate that swirled around this club and the whole sex business of Chicago and elsewhere?
Well, white slavery, was the notion that girls were being drugged, raped, kidnapped, and sold into brothels, never to be heard from again. And it was a, you know, it was something that these reformers, these ministers and these politicians who wanted to start railing against prostitution and against the Victorian notion that we needed these segregated districts, they sort of seized upon this idea to rally the public and spread fear. And it was very effective. There were thousands of books and articles and journals sent out all across America talking about how your sister, your niece, your neighbor, your friend, your daughter is going to be the next person who's going to vanish in a brothel in Chicago or elsewhere and never be heard from again. You know, these women in rural hometowns would scour Women's World for recipes or needlepoint tips and come across these really frightening articles. It was sort of, you know, progressive era terror alerts. And the politicians were really effective at manipulating this fear.
Of course, you note in the book that your own great aunt may have been one of those. She came from Slovenia into the urban America and vanished.
It was my great grandmother and her sister. Yeah, they both came to America from Slovenia in 1905 and settled in Pittsburgh. But the sister one weekend took a trip to Chicago and was never heard from again. And that, you know, I was always haunted and intrigued by this bit of family lore.
Linda Gordon, I wanted to ask you, Karen Abbott describes a time when American men going off to a bordello might imagine themselves as actually doing their wives a favor because they wouldn't be imposing their sexual appetites on their Victorian era wife. Do you understand that as part of the culture of this time, that outlook? Or is that just a rationale?
I think actually it was largely a rationale. And if you asked their wives, I don't think their wives would have approved of that. But it was a fairly widespread notion, and it came from the rather official view of the Victorian culture, which is that respectable women really had no sexual interest, no sexual drive. In fact, many of the so-called experts of that period argued that the analog of the male sex drive in women was a maternal drive, that women submitted to sex in order to have children. But I still think it was largely irrational, and I think that the most important thing in understanding it, actually, is to look at prostitution from the perspective of the prostitutes and to consider how they got there, why they got there.
Karen, what about it? The Wall Street Journal reviewed your book, and they began their review with this old joke. It says, a young man walking up the stairs to a bordello encounters his father coming down the stairs and says, Dad, what are you doing here? And the father replies, and this seems kind of in the spirit of your book, for $2, his father replies, why bother your mother? How do you describe the sort of relationship of men, women, sex, bordellos at that time? Can we apply our current perspective to it and understand what was going on or not?
Well, I think the other part, I agree, you know, and I think that the other part of that equation is that the reformers spoke a lot about the double standard of morality. And what they meant by that was that women were expected to be virtuous and not have sexual appetites. And men, on the other hand, were, you know, encouraged and sort of, you know, people turned a blind eye if they wanted to sort of experiment and satisfy all of their desires. And the reformers, you know, one of their talking points was that we need to erase this double standard of morality and have young men, encourage young men to aspire to the moral purity of girls. And, you know, the great irony of that, of course, which would horrify the progressive reformers today is that, you know, women have adopted the sexual freedoms that were once reserved exclusively for men.
Linda Gordon points to the women themselves. I want to get your perspective on that, but I wonder if you might read for us a little bit from the prologue. There's a bit where you describe all 30 Everly Club's employees kind of upstairs preparing, just to get a sense of how your portraying this.
Sure. All 30 Everly Club harlots remained upstairs in their boudoirs, preparing for the night ahead, running razors under their arms, down and between their legs. Clients didn't have a smooth woman at home. They packed themselves with sponges, made certain they had enough douche, checked cabinets for the little black pills that, along with 30 days of hot baths, usually brought a girl around from any unwanted condition. They yanked and tied one another's corsets, buttoned up gowns made of slippery silk, unrolled black stockings over long legs. Hair was wound tight with pins or left to fall in tousled waves, depending on the preference of the regulars. A dab of gasoline, the newest fad in perfume if you couldn't afford an automobile. Behind the ears, across the wrists and ankles, and between the breasts. Eyes rimmed in black and lashes painted, standing stiffer than the prongs of a fork. Each courtesan had a name chosen by her peers. Once she entered this life, the life, she discarded all remnants of the one she left behind.
So was this glamorous or was this painted slavery?
You know, I think that in the Everly Club, it was glamorous. It was considered a compliment to be there. You know, in other houses, not so much. They, as I said before, they treated their girls as disposable commodities. A lot of them employed a whipper on staff to mete out discipline.
A whipper, as in wield the whip in the rest of the levy.
Oh, yes. In fact, one of the Everly sisters' main rivals, a madam by the name of Vic Shawl, who I write about in the book quite frequently, she was quite a character, employed a whipper named Lil. Lil Kowalski, Lil the Whipper, and her big boast was that she beat up over 1,000 harlots during her employment.
Great. Very funny. Not really at all. What about the power structure of Chicago at that time, mainly male? What was its interaction with the whole district of prostitution, with this club in particular?
Well, the two main politicians in Chicago at the time were colorful gentlemen by the name of Bathhouse John Coughlin and Hinky Dink Kenna. And they were aldermen of the First Ward. The First Ward was interesting because it encompassed both the levee district and all the dives and the saloons and the brothels, and also a lot of really upscale Chicago stores, restaurants, businesses. So it was sort of all over the place. But Bathhouse John and Hinky Dink, you know, depended on this very quid pro quo graft system between all the brothel keepers and madams and saloon men. They paid very steeply for protection fees in order to remain open. And Bathhouse John and Hinky Dink, you know, benefited from this and controlled the whole area. Once a year, they threw a big bash called the First Word Ball. And it was this sort of opportunity for everybody in the levee district to celebrate themselves with impunity. And everybody, you know, 30,000 of them would just cram into Chicago's Coliseum and, you know, beer weighed and knee deep in beer. And, you know, people were face down in glass. People were whipping each other and stabbing each other with hat pins and just drinking and sort of fighting and dancing. And it was they enjoyed every bit of it. And it sort of netted $30,000 on average for Bathhouse John and Hinky Dink's political coffers.
Wow. Carl Sandburg writing says, here's the difference between us and Dante. Of course, Carl Sandburg, the great kind of poet of Chicago. He wrote a lot about hell and never saw the place. We're writing about Chicago after looking the town over. Karen Abbott, Linda Gordon, please stand by. I have a lot of listeners who want to join us. Mark is calling from Clare, Michigan. Mark, you're on the line, on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Your discussion has reminded me about John Steinbeck's very different descriptions of bordellos in a couple different novels that he wrote from about that period. One was East of Eden, where the bordello was a very nasty, seedy, drug-infested, perverse place. And the other was Cannery Row, where the bordello, the women were the most altruistic in the community. They fed people during times of famine, and they took care of everyone during the flu epidemic, and just how differently in the same city. I think they were both set in Monterey, California, but the bordello was viewed by the same author in two very different books.
Yeah, absolutely, and those are vivid descriptions there. Linda Gordon, what about Steinbeck's depiction? And, of course, it's a little later, but at this time, the turn of that century, about the country's perception of this. The preachers were outside railing against it. Was anybody railing for it?
No, no one spoke in such an open way in defense of prostitution. But you see, there's been for a long time, ever since the birth of Victorianism, a very deep cultural split about prostitution. And I think you see it most clearly if you look at it from the point of view of the prostitutes. Is this a job? Is this a way that people go and choose rationally to earn a living because it's preferable to anything else that's available to them? Or is prostitution inevitably something that creates degenerates and depraved people? And interestingly enough, that that difference of opinion exists still today. And furthermore, it exists among feminists. It's quite interesting, both in terms of the women's rights movement of the earlier period that Karen Abbott is talking about, mm-hmm. but also that of the 1970s. Prostitution is an issue that feminists could never agree about. There were some who believed that it needed to be legal, that it was a job, that prostitutes had a right to unionize, and there are others who believe that this is just a sign of the victimization of women and could never be any different. And the caller is quite right to look at these different images. Prostitution is such an emotionally and morally loaded a practice that the culture is full of myths about prostitution. The prostitute with the heart of gold, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. depraved victim of sex traffickers or white slave traffickers, as they used to be called.
Mm-hmm. I want to get Karen's view on that, but let me go first to a caller in Georgetown, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know?
Well, here in Georgetown, South Carolina, we had at least a locally and regionally famous brothel called the Sunset Lodge, and it operated here in the 30s and into the early 60s. Mm. In fact, there's a wonderful book written about it called Keeper of the House.
Mm.
And my grandmother, I found out it very late in her life that she revealed to her family, her grandchildren, that she ran a brothel in Kansas City. So saying that, you know, I have this fondness in my heart for a profession that's technically illegal. But
so your grandmother ran a brothel, owned a brothel in Kansas City, Missouri, but she waited until the end of her life to tell you, so her pride was not exactly blooming in that.
No. And my father knew of it because he had childhood memories of sleeping with whoever wasn't on duty. As a young child, he was taken care of by various employees of my grandmother.
Wow.
So it was kind of interesting to hear. And the point that I guess I want to make is, and I don't know how well received this will be, is that, you know, I think that marriages result in extramarital affairs probably more than half the time, you know, it seems like. And you look in any city's yellow pages and you see pages sometimes of, I guess they're called escort service.
Right.
And who knows what they really are. But mm-hmm. this phenomenon and this business has been in our culture historically for forever, and I don't think it's always such an immoral bad thing if it's done in a way like the state of Nevada does.
Bob, thanks for your call. Karen Abbott, there's a lot there for us to put to you, but let's first put Bob's fondness for the profession to you. You looked at the Everly Club in detail, the lives of the women there. How do you respond when a man says he feels some fondness and sees a place for this?
Well, you know, there are many reasons women joined the profession. It wasn't all, you know, they didn't all just flock to the Everly Club because they heard of these fabulous salaries and because they wanted to wear couture gowns. You know, there was a lot of sadness there. Many of them joined because of the death of their family. They were forced to support some of them. Their husbands left or also died. They had nothing else to do. Some of them were kicked out of their homes because they were promiscuous. Their parents considered them promiscuous, and they figured, well, you know, if I'm going to have that reputation, I might as well make a living at it. Mm. You know, it was a lot of financial necessity that some of them joined. You know, the difference with the Everly sisters were, you know, they did get girls who came from those circumstances. But the difference with Everly sisters was that they also made sure the girls understood that they were free to leave at any time. They weren't enslaved there. It was not, you know, and when the reformers
And was that for real or was that just rhetoric? Were they indeed free to leave if they wanted to?
Yeah, there were several times when one of the reformers I speak about in the book is a minister by the name of Ernest Bell,
mm-hmm.
and he preached outside of the Everly Club every night and was invited in quite a few times to have a tour and to speak with the sisters and to speak with the courtesans. And Minna boastfully said to him, you know, if you can persuade any of them to leave, do so. And, you know, I bet you they won't. And according to Edgar Lee Masters and Theodore Dreiser, who both reported on this incident, you know, none of them ever chose to leave after a visit from Ernest Bell.
The Midnight Mission didn't get converts there. What about, I mean, in this case and in others, like in Bob's, his grandmother, but in this case, this was a bordello owned and run by women and very, very profitably. When it finally fell apart, they were I guess, rich. What did Minna and Ada Everly think of what they were doing? Did they have, I don't know, in the kind of feminist spectrum, let's say, of perspectives that Linda Gordon said, you know, describes? On the one hand, this is a job. On the other, this is the ultimate degradation. How did Minna and Ada look at it?
Well, they looked at it as they were attempting to elevate the profession. They understood that it had a baser side. They understood that there was a lot of degrading things going on among women in other houses. But their thinking was if they were able to elevate the industry to provide these girls with a decent wage and a respectable place to live and you know, an opulent place to live and treated them well and educated them and treated them as valuable investments rather than disposable commodities, that they would be doing everybody a favor. They reasoned that this was a business that was always going to exist, regardless of any reform movements, you know, the wave, the ebb and flow of that. And if they were able to sort of remove the stain from the profession, that it would benefit everyone.
Let's go to Rita in Richmond, Virginia. Let me get one call before the break. Lyndon, we'll come right to you. But Rita in Richmond, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I recently read a story about one of my relatives, distant relative, whose name was Chicago May, and among other things that she did, she was a prostitute in Chicago at that time. And in reading this book, I discovered that the women of the prostitutes of the time, maybe they were making $100 a week at this opulent place, but in order to do that, the prostitutes of that time were servicing between 25 and 50 men a night.
Good Lord.
A night.
That is no day or night at the beach.
It doesn't make it look that wonderful that you have to that you get to wear pretty dresses and eat great food.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that if they got pregnant or left, that those dresses were not theirs to take with them.
I imagine that may be true. Linda Gordon, what do you say here? Rita, thanks for that. Linda?
Well, she's absolutely right. And I actually have a certain amount of respect for the Everly sisters, but one of the things you have to keep in mind is that the number of clients who can pay that kind of money is going to be very, very limited. And most prostitution serves men of extremely limited means.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I also want to underline something that Karen Abbott just said that's extremely important, and that is that in 1854, at the beginning of the first really major anti-prostitution reform effort in this country, an extraordinary report was published by William Sanger, the first person to actually do an actual study of prostitutes, to talk to them and ask about them. And he found something that was extremely shocking to the reformers, and that is that most of these women denied having been coerced or forced in any way. And he was one of the first to look at and take quite seriously their own explanation of how they got there, which was usually that they couldn't find another job that they needed to support themselves. Often they were mothers left alone with kids and had no way of supporting those kids. On the other hand, when you get closer to the era that Karen Abbott is writing about, you find another disturbing fact, and that is that an extremely high proportion of female prostitutes had been the victims of child sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that psychologists conclude is that these are girls who learn at a very, very young age that one of the few things they had that was valued was their sexuality, and that they could sell it and live on it, but that this decision came out of actually very low self-esteem.
It may have led to them being sort of tossed out of a social circle that they knew well. Karen Abbott, you know, saying you did it of your own free will, but doing it when it's the only job you can find, or when it's a kind of a result of a view of the world formed by child sex abuse, hardly sounds like really robust free will, the kind we'd like to imagine.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to comment on something the last caller said. She's absolutely right that at many houses, the volume of clients, it was just, you know, astonishing and quite degrading. And, you know, these women were forced to work when they were ill with disease.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know, they would employ charlatan doctors to forge medical reports and just force the girls to keep working and not get any treatment. At the Everly Club, again, that wasn't true. In fact, one of the first things Minna said to her girls was, one $50 client is better than 10 $5 ones, less wear and tear. So even that, and they did employ a respectable, reputable doctor in their house to make sure their girls were well taken care of in that regard. And even encouraged them, as the Chicago Vice Commission later found out, encouraged them to perform sex acts that were not as risque or risky as other ones might be, medically speaking.
So a little discretion woven through there in this one very, very kind of top of the heap spot.
Right, exactly. So there was that. And also I wanted to comment on Linda's point. It's true, too, that these girls, you know, a lot of them were victims of sexual abuse as well. And it was also an inherited circumstance. I remember one incident, and I included in the book, mm-hmm. where a young girl, her mother was a prostitute, and she grew up in that whole atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Her virginity was auctioned off when she was maybe 10, and her rationale for you know joining the profession herself, you know, in a few years later, was that, well, you know, you always do what your parents do. You know, I'm joining this brothel because that's what my parents do. You know, if your parents have a grocery store, you know, you become a clerk in a grocery store. Well, my father didn't sell groceries.
In the family trade then.
It becomes a family trade then.
Let's go to Joe calling from Boston. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's a terrific show. I run a bordello in the greater Boston area.
What did you say, Joe?
I run a bordello in the greater Boston area.
Not a century ago, but right now.
Right now. Today, this weekend.
Okay. How many women do you employ?
About 25 women, some who only come... the women set their own schedules, so there are some who are with us for a week out of every month because they travel, or some who just come in for a weekend, and there are some who are regulars.
So, and is it an actual place, or people just call in for kind of escort service treatment?
Oh, no, it's an actual place.
And how do you have the courage to call in? Aren't you afraid about police?
Well, Joe's not my real name, and I figure the greater Boston area is pretty vague, so...
Okay, and then what's your point or your question, Joe?
Well, I guess my point was the reason I called was the circumstances that women find themselves in this line of work. I mean, I know plenty of people with normal jobs who feel who wish they could get out of them, and I mean, I think for many of them, many of the women who work for me, or I mean, I happen to think that I run a nice, clean, respectable establishment. I mean, the choice is working for me, which they seem to enjoy, or working at a fast food restaurant, which they would hate. The hours would be, the pay would be lower.
And what about their background? Do you find that many of them have been abused as young women or girls, sexually abused?
I run a business. While I'm close personal friends with some of my employees, I'm not close personal friends with all of them, and that's not the sort of thing that one really generally talks about in the workplace.
You're not their psychologist. You're the boss.
I'm a boss. I'm their employer. Yeah. It's a sad statistic that a certain percentage of the world was abused as children, and if you look around, if you could sort of peel back the covers in any workplace, you'd find out that some of the people there were sexually abused. But it's not the sort of thing that people talk about. My workplace is no different than any other in that respect.
Joe, you are unusual among our callers, but it's interesting to hear from you. Thank you for calling, Linda Gordon. What do you think a progressive era reformer would have said to Joe, and what do you say to him today?
Well, you know, if we want to think about prostitution today, I think it's useful to think about it in terms of cultural changes today and what you might call the casualization of sex. I'm a college professor, mm-hmm. so I am in touch with lots and lots of young people, and I know that there is quite a different sexual ethic and a notion that sex is, to use a quote, good, clean fun. And once you start thinking about sex that way, which is a very respectable way of thinking about it, you might say, well, why not get paid for it? When you want to go back and think about sexually abused kids, I made a big study about this because mm-hmm. I wrote a book about child abuse. What constitutes prostitution? If a guy gets a 10-year-old to have sex with him and then gives her a pretty bracelet as a present, is that prostitution?
Well, that's statutory rape.
Well, it wasn't at the time mm-hmm. because the Mann Act had not been passed yet and the age of consent did not make it statutory rape in all places.
And we have to come to the Mann Act because it grows right out of the Everly Club and that milieu. But the point you're driving to, Linda?
The point I'm driving at is that there's room for legitimate difference of opinion. A woman has a right to sell her own body. That's one point of view. The other point of view is that such an extreme commercialization of functions of the body has to be morally degrading. I actually don't have a very clear opinion myself. I think it's a very iffy question. And the thing that I care about most is the point that you were trying to make. What constitutes free will? If you don't have other good choices, and this is your choice, to what extent is that really freely chosen?
Let's go to Rona, calling from New Britain, Connecticut. Hi, Rona. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I had sort of two questions. One was about the sort of if she's done any sort of comparison of how it is in countries where prostitution is legalized, you know, if there's less of this, if there's more protections, et cetera, and if it's more acceptable.
Right.
And, you know, what happens then in those situations, like in Amsterdam.
And what about Chicago a year ago? A question there? A century ago, I should say.
Yeah, and then the question about a century ago was about this particular brothel that she's talking about. Were there African American women in there as well, or was it an all white run establishment, etc.?
So. It's a great question, and in a funny way, brings us around to the Mann Act, which grows out of this. Karen, what about race and interracial relations? The Everly Club and the whole Levee District of Chicago at that time. What can you tell us?
Well, it's an interesting question. And the Everly sisters, you know, they had these very specific rules about their club. They made a point of saying that they weren't personally prejudiced, but they did not allow black clientele in their club. There were plenty of other places in the Levee District that did cater to black clientele or who did strictly employ just black women who catered to white men. It was sort of very delineated by ethnicity all along the Levee District.
But the great black boxer Jack Johnson did intersect with one
did.
Of our gals.
Yeah, it was one night in 1909, he showed up at the door. He was the, you know, heavyweight champion of the world at the time and so had some clout. Also, his manager happened to be a big player in the Levee District. And Minna understood, you know, the rules of her own club, and she also understood the rules of the Levee District, which dictated that his manager could enforce his way into the club or else, you know, maybe Minna's protection payment wouldn't have been honored the next month and the cops would have shown up. So Jack Johnson did spend the night at the Everly Club. And the other thing that Minna didn't count on was that her harlots found him charming.
Yeah.
And five of them happened to leave with him. And one in particular, a woman named Belle Schreiber, became his paramour for quite some time. And she was directly responsible for his eventually getting arrested on one of the first Mann Act violations.
And draw the line. I mean, the Mann Act came out of this very time and this very environment.
Yeah, it was the result of another person I write about in the book, a politician lawyer by the name of Clifford Rowe, was very active in pushing legislation all across the country, anti-pandering laws, he called them, that would provide for stiff fines against men who were suspected of trafficking women. And he sort of was directly responsible for rallying the federal government to get behind this. this whole movement. And the Mann Act was passed in June of 1910 by President Taft and forbade the transportation of women across state lines for, quote unquote, immoral purposes. And no one ever really clearly defined what immoral purposes were, which led to some problems down the line.
So the great boxer Jack Johnson's very popular at the club, but the race card came into play as he ran into that buzzsaw. Let me take a call from Lisa in Worcester, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that Karen's brothel is part of a continuum of Chicago history that's had a national connection with sex. In 1893, you saw the belly dancers of the Columbian Exposition, and then after, you see the 1933-1934 Sally Rand and her fan dance at the second time that Chicago tried a World's Fair.
So it was a great Chicago tradition. I've got a note here saying you've actually written about this, Lisa, and been cited by Karen.
Yeah, I think we talked very early in her preparation. I'm so excited to see the book.
Oh, hi, Lisa. Yeah.
And it's a very important book in understanding this period, which is really crucial to understanding Chicago. And I think it's interesting that Chicago can't shake this reputation until into the 50s and 60s. And, of course, it's the place where the trains stop and the place where all the businessmen go, even now, to go on their conventions and things.
I mean, having grown up with Chicago as the nearest urban area, though it was very far away, but I was sort of halfway to Amish country, and for a man just to travel there alone, got a cocked eyebrow pretty quickly, long after the Everly Club closed, Karen. Lisa, thanks for that. Karen, tell us the end of this story. What brought the club down, and what became of the Everly sisters?
Well, I think the beginning of the end, that first word ball that I described earlier, that sort of crazy, tumultuous party that they threw once a year, that in the 1908, that became sort of the Battle of Gettysburg. You know, the public was pretty well aware at the time of how clearly debauched that was. And, you know,
that was the theme of the sort of wild ribald party.
Yes, oh yes,
gosh.
It was. Well, I mean, it just became a turning point in terms of rallying the public to, mm-hmm. you know, the public for a long time also understood that segregated districts were a necessary evil and sort of fell on that side of the equation. But, you know, it was the reform movement sort of gathered momentum. And after the Mann Act was passed and you have, you know, the President of the United States stepping in, you have newspapers across the country talking about this in editorial pages, saying this is 1,000 times worse than black slavery ever was. You know, your daughter is about to disappear forever. It was at the point where the hysteria had gotten so widespread and just so pervasive that the Everly sisters were the first victims of this. They were the most visible brothel in the world and certainly in the United States. And so they sort of took the first fall.
They packed up their fortune, as you write, and headed off to New York City and lived out the rest of their very long years, one even until the 1960s, off the fortune built there on the sort of a gilded bordello streets of Chicago.
Yeah, they retired with about $1 million, which was equivalent of $20 million today, and sort of came full circle. They resumed these lives of mystery and again myth making and sort of reinvented themselves once again. They were great spin doctors, and very cunning in presenting themselves as they wished to be presented. And nobody in New York knew who they were. They thought they were these pristine old women running a poetry circle. And,
whose grandfather had been in the gold rush. And that's all we've got time for today. But what a great story. Karen Abbott, author of Sin in the Second City. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And Linda Gordon, author of The Moral Property of Women, there at NYU. You've got a great eye and wisdom, Linda, and we appreciate your sharing it with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've got an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org.